Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. It doesn't matter whether you call this Sunday Palm Sunday or Passion Sunday. It's all the same insofar as it is the opening of Holy Week, the most sacred period of the Church's year. We recall a brief moment of earthly triumph and the recognition that Jesus was the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Yet we are also reminded in the Gospel of the Passion that his kingdom is not of this world. As we receive a palm, we automatically make it into a cross. Before we can celebrate the resurrection, there is Calvary. In today's programme, Joan Lewis and I look at a major concern of the Pope and the European bishops, that Europe's Christian foundations are being ignored. But first, in the Gospel for this Sunday, we once again remember the suffering of Jesus on our behalf. Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett tell us more.
Pilate called together the chief priests, the ruling class, and the people, and said to them, "You have brought this man before me as one who subverts the people. I have examined him in your presence, and have no charge against him arising from your allegations. Neither has Herod, who therefore has sent him back to us. Obviously this man has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore I mean to release him, once I have taught him a lesson." The whole crowd cried out, "Away with this man, release Barabbas for us." Pilate addressed them again, for he wanted Jesus to be the one he released. But they shouted back, "Crucify him, crucify him." He said to them for the third time, "What wrong is this man guilty of? I have not discovered anything about him deserving the death penalty. I will therefore chastise him and release him." But they demanded with loud cries that he be crucified, and their shouts increased in violence. Pilate then decreed that what they demanded should be done. He released the one they asked for, who had been thrown in prison for insurrection and murder, and delivered Jesus up to their wishes. A great crowd of people followed him, including women who beat their breasts and lamented over him. Two others were crucified along with him. When they came to Skull Place, as it was called, they crucified him there and the criminals as well, one on his right and the other on his left. The people stood there watching, and the leaders kept jeering at him, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Messiah of God, the Chosen One." The soldiers also made fun of him, coming forward to offer him their sour wine, and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was an inscription over his head, "This is the King of the Jews." Around midday, and darkness came over the whole land, until mid-afternoon with an eclipse of the sun. The curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two. Jesus uttered a loud cry and said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." After this, he expired. The centurion, upon seeing what had happened, gave glory to God by saying, "Surely this was the Son of God." After the crowd assembled for this spectacle witnessed what had happened, they returned beating their breasts. All his friends and the women who had accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, watching everything.
The sixth Sunday of Lent, which was formerly known as Palm Sunday, is now officially entitled Palm Sunday of the Passion of Christ. So runs its full title, showing, writes a liturgist, that the liturgy of the day will unite two commemorations, that of the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem and that of his Passion. The origin of Palm Sunday is explained in The Liturgical Year.
The diary of Egeria the Pilgrim tells us that at the beginning of the 5th century, the Christians of Jerusalem used to gather in the early afternoon on the Mount of Olives for a lengthy liturgy of the Word. Then, toward evening, they would go in procession into Jerusalem, carrying palm branches or olive branches. This rite was soon esteemed and imitated in other churches of the East. As for its spread in the West, the name Palm Sunday occurs in Spain and Gaul around 600, but there's no procession with the palms. in these countries, the gospel for the Mass of the sixth Sunday of Lent was taken from John 12, which tells of the anointing at Bethany. But the passage continued on to the story of the entrance into Jerusalem. For this reason, the Sunday soon acquired the name of Palm Sunday, although there was as yet no special ceremony in commemoration of the event. The custom of blessing the palm branches is attested around the middle of the 8th century. Since palm and olive branches were obtainable only in southern countries, the custom was early introduced of blessing the green and blossoming branches of other trees, including beech branches. In Germany, it was usually branches of willows that already had their catkins.
And in medieval England, we hear, palms were often made from willow, box and yew. But willow is still used to this day. In Richard Mabie's Flora Britannica, we read, the Christian festival of Eastertide begins with Palm Sunday, when sprays of pussy willow or yew are sometimes used as substitutes for true palm. The pussy willow or sallow are vernacular names for the goat willow, the commonest and most widespread willows in Britain, and the earliest to flower. The catkins are put out before the leaves, silky, silver-grey buds. They used to be called goslings, writes Mabie, because their texture and colour were like newly hatched geese. And as children, we love them. In his Prospect of Flowers, Andrew Young tells us that the sallow's catkins come a little later than those of the hazel, for, he writes,
the sallow, observant of the church's ritual, waits to provide palm for Palm Sunday. The sallow, or palm willow, grows anywhere, and early in March we may see in some sheltered spot, perhaps a hollow wood, as the first sign of spring, among willows at least, the satin shining palm. By the end of March these buds have opened, the catkins on the make, trees yellow with pollen. And through the leafless underwood, rich stains of sunny gold show where the sallows bloom.
So wrote John Clare in the early 19th century, and a 20th century comment seems to confirm the continuance of a long tradition.
I remember attending Sunday school on Palm Sunday and wearing a sprig of pussy willow, and my father was always told, you get your hair pulled if you don't wear a piece of palm on Palm Sunday.
But what was the significance of the palm? It gets its name from the Latin palma, palm of the hand, from the spread hand appearance of the tree. It's a symbol of resolution, overcoming calamity. It's said by Orientals to have sprung from the residue of the clay of which Adam was formed. But when someone talks about their palmy days, they're referring to prosperous or happy days, as those were to a victorious gladiator, to whom the Romans gave a branch of the palm tree as a reward for his prowess. From this too comes our expression to bear the palm, while to yield the palm a victory is to admit another's superiority in a given field. Here in Italy we have olive branches on Palm Sunday, and on that first Palm Sunday the branches were of both palms and olives, for both trees grew in the area. In a poem by Robert Browning, The Patriot, its hero is greeted with roses and myrtle, which was sacred to Venus and a symbol of love. But the patriot of the poem is on his way to execution and is remembering with bitterness the acclamation of the populace a year earlier.
It was roses, roses all the way, with myrtle mixed in my path like mad. The house roofs seemed to heave and sway, the church spires flamed, such flags they had, a year ago on this very day. The air broke into a mist with bells, the old walls rocked with the crowd and cries. There's nobody on the housetops now, just a palsied few at the window set, for the best of the sight is, all allow, at the shambles' gate, or better yet, by the very scaffold's foot, I trow.
The Shambles Gate was probably very near the place of execution, shambles originally meaning a stall in a market where meat was sold, and later meaning a slaughterhouse. Jesus had the crowds always, on his day of triumph and on that of his death. And a scholar makes this reflection on the shouts of Hosanna.
In the song of the crowd of disciples, there's almost an answer to the angelic greeting in the hymn for the birth of Christ. The angels sang, "Glory to God in the highest, and peace on earth to the men he loves." Now the disciples proclaim, "Peace in heaven, and glory in the highest heavens."
And from the Palms we come now to the Passion. Our Gospel today, in the short form, of which we've just heard a part, begins with the first words of chapter 23 of Luke's Gospel, with Jesus already being taken to Pilate. But the long version of the Gospel begins at the opening of the previous chapter, with the treason of Judas, the Last Supper, and the institution of the Eucharist. And then Jesus and the disciples go to the Mount of Olives, as usual, we read. Only when they get there, Jesus withdraws from them, after telling them to pray not to be put to the test. Luke writes that he was only about a stone's throw away, but it's as if he were thousands of miles away, totally alone. In all his life, he has never been so alone as at this moment. He prays for the cup to be taken from him, but then, "Nevertheless, let your will be done, not mine." In his poem, The Olive Garden, Rainer Maria Rilke imagines the agony of Jesus as he goes on, not just a little further, but upward.
And still he climbed, and through the grey leaves thrust, quite grey and lost in the grey olive lands, and laid his burning forehead full of dust, deep in the dustiness of burning hands. After all, this, and this then, was the end. Now I'm to go, while I'm going blind, and oh, why wilt thou have me still contend, thou art, whom I myself no longer find? No more I find thee, in myself no tone of thee, nor in the rest, nor in this stone. I can find thee no more. I am alone. I am alone with all that human fate I undertook through thee to mitigate. Thou, who art not, oh shame do consummate. An angel came, those afterwards relate. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night, and turned the leaves of trees indifferently, and the disciples stirred uneasily. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night.
The night came indeed, and with it Judas and arrest, interrogation by Annas, Caiaphas, the Sanhedrin, Peter's denial, cockcrow. What a night. Where did he spend it? With the guards, presumably, who had their sport with him, mocking him, beating him, blindfolding him, and asking him, "Who hit you?" Jesus of a certainty had no sleep that night. The guards on duty would have seen to that. And a line from a poem about a street vagrant comes to mind. Where did last night's Christ lie down? Day breaks, and the chief priests and the elders and the scribes, who have had a night's sleep, meet in council and have Jesus brought to them. "Is he the Christ? Is he the Son of God?" is all they ask now. And his answer decides them. He must die, and so to Pilate. Of the four evangelists, only John reports the dialogue between Jesus and Pilate in any length. But they all quote the question, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And the answer, "It is you who say it." Because this was the ultimate indictment, his claim to be king. The real reason for the Sanhedrin's sentence of death was his claim to be son of God. But Pilate would not have understood the gravity which such a blasphemy had in their eyes. So the reason was given a political slant. As Pilate does not yield immediately, the chief priests add that Jesus has been stirring up the people with his teaching, from Galilee, where he began, to this very place. Galilee, Herod's territory. So Pilate sends him to Herod, who sends him back. Pilate then offers to release Jesus instead of Barabbas. But by now the crowd has become a howling mob, and there is no turning back.
They demanded with loud cries that he be crucified, and their shouts increased in violence. Pilate then decreed that what they demanded should be done.
And it was. And to close these reflections, here are some lines from The Killing by Edwin Moore, said against the background of Luke's words. "That was the day they killed the Son of God on a squat hilltop by Jerusalem. Zion was bare, her children from their maze sucked by the demon curiosity clean through the gates. The very halt and blind had somehow got themselves up the hill.
A great crowd of people followed him, including women who beat their breasts and lamented over him.
After the ceremonial preparation, the scourging, nailing against the wood, erection of the main trees with their burden, while from the hill rose an orchestral wailing, they were there at last, high up in the soft spring day. We watched the writhings, heard the moanings, saw the three heads turning on their separate axles like broken wheels left spinning. Round his head was loosely bound a crown of plaited thorn that hurt at random, stinging temple and brow as the pain swung into its envious circle.
The people stood there watching, and the leaders kept jeering at him. The soldiers also made fun of him.
Some who came to stare grew silent as they looked, indignant or sorry. But the hardened old and the hard-hearted young, although at odds from the first morning, cursed him with one curse, having prayed for a rabbi or an armed messiah, and found the Son of God. What use to them was a god or a son of God? Of what avail for purposes such as theirs? Beside the crossfoot, alone, four women stood and did not move all day. The sun revolved, the shadow wheeled.
And darkness came over the whole land. The curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two. Jesus uttered a loud cry and said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." After he said this, he expired.
Death was slow and came so quietly they scarce could mark it.
After the crowd assembled for this spectacle, witnessed what had happened, they returned beating their breasts. All his friends and the women who had accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, watching everything.
I was a stranger, could not read these people or this outlandish deity. Did a god indeed in dying cross my life that day by chance? He on his road and I on mine.
From the opening Gospel of Holy Week, we now move on to look at some of the Vatican's concerns of the past few days. Well, Joan, welcome back.
It's good to be back and to be in Rome as we are about to begin Holy Week and to do the program once again. And seems, in a way, though I have been away, it seems like it was just yesterday that we taped this show. And just since I've been back, only a few days now, I've been looking at, obviously, the big stories of the week. There were quite a number of interesting interventions by the Holy Father over last weekend. He met a group of Communion and Liberation celebrating an anniversary, and about 80,000 of them were in St. Peter's Square. The Pope also went to a parish on Sunday and had some very interesting words to say about hell, reminding people that it does exist.
Well, one of the other big things last weekend was, of course, it was the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome and the establishment of the European Union. Well, the European bishops were here in Rome last week, and also the Holy Father mentioned them on Sunday. But one of the big concerns has been that the new European Constitution leaves out the whole Christian roots of Europe.
Well, you know, it's an amazing thing. And actually, if any of our listeners have been with us even for a couple of years now, they know that, I'm going to say a year and a half, 2 years ago, there was this huge campaign before the signing of the Constitution, before the signing of the preamble and everything by the individual states in Europe. There was this huge campaign in the Vatican, and particularly the Vatican, the Osservatore Romano, the newspaper, where it had a headline always on a kind of a grayish banner that said, either Europe is Christian or it is not Europe. And that would be on the paper every day for like 7 months. And then there was an article, like an editorial by some church figure from various countries and theologians, bishops, whatever, about the Christian roots of Europe, and you just can't. It's a reality, and it's a huge reality, and to deny it, as Europe is trying to do in its constitution, is to deny something very real, something very big, and something that was an intimate, innate part of Christian of history in Europe.
Well, not all people realize that the very flag of the European Union, which is the blue background and the 12 stars, the blue is actually for Our Lady, and the 12 stars are the 12 stars of her crown.
And the Pope took the occasion. It was really an incredible speech. I do not know, as we are talking, if this was available in English on the Vatican website, but his talk to the bishops, who, as you mentioned, were in Rome for this event, his talk was very forceful, very powerful, and this part about Christianity really was the centerpiece of his entire talk. He began actually talking about demographic terms, and he said, unfortunately, it must be noted that Europe seems on a path that could lead to its exit from history, because the various countries, people are not replacing themselves. The birth rate is so low in many places that people are dying faster than they are being replaced by a new generation. And the Pope also said that it seems that the European continent is losing faith in its own future. And certainly, if you're not going to mention Christianity, that comes to mind. And in talking about this process of unification, which continues, the European Union began as a small number of countries. It is now, if I am correct, 27 countries that are members of the European Union. And he said the process of this unification is not shared by everyone because various chapters, and he didn't go into that, of the European project were written without taking adequate account of the wishes of its citizens. And then here's where he says powerfully, what emerges from all of this is that it is unthinkable to create an authentic common European home while ignoring the identity of the people of our continent. And that identity, he said, is made up of a collection of universal values which Christianity contributed to creating. And he said, how can the people, who the governments of this union, how can they exclude such an essential element of European identity as Christianity, in which a vast majority of people continue to identify themselves?
Well, we've had 2,000 years of Christianity.
And, I mean, to deny, all you have to do is look at schools, look at universities, look at libraries, look, obviously, at the churches, the cathedrals, the basilicas. The impact on art, on history, on religion, on culture, on music of Christianity is huge and undeniable. And to put it to the side because you are lily-livered as a politician and don't wish to offend some people by mentioning Christianity, how can you offend some people if you eliminate what was a true, real, existing, is a true, real, existing element of European culture?
Even on language, you might not realize, but that there are a number of words in the English language that were actually coined by St. Thomas More because he needed a word to express a concept, and a word didn't exist. So he created a word. So even some of the words in our ordinary everyday language have come to us from one of the saints.
Well, you know, a lot of times people don't like to look at the past because there might be negative elements in it, but that's part of life. I mean, it's like looking at a person who, we're all imperfect. We all have our flaws. But if you look at a person and absolutely just eliminate the flaws or concentrate only on flaws or on good points, you're not looking at the whole person. And that's basically what's happening in Europe if you don't look at Christianity. You're denying the biggest part of the history of this of this continent.
Yep.
So a speech worth reading several times, and worth noting that the Holy Father did not just bring this up Saturday, that this has been a huge part of many papal speeches and writings, of speeches and writings, obviously, of other members of the Roman Curia of the Catholic Church. And I don't think this will be the last we're going to hear of it either.
Oh, no.
So, and of course, you know, interestingly enough, the Constitution, when it was voted on by the members of, I don't remember what the date was, when it was voted on by the member nations of the European Union, for it to pass, it had to have 100%. And there were several nations which did not vote on it. Now, if they can come back to the table and insert Christianity, insert some other elements that will make these people vote for it, then maybe all of these words, all of these articles, all of this stress on the Christianity, on this aspect of the roots will pay off. Let's hope. We can also pray. Sometimes we don't feel we see the fruit of prayer, but, you know, prayer is real, exactly, as is Christianity. Well, that was a powerful speech this week. It wasn't obviously the only thing on the Pope's agenda. We had a very interesting audience, actually, on Wednesday, the general audience in St. Peter's Square. And the Pope has been focusing on people in the early church, and he dedicated his Catechesis Wednesday to Irenaeus, the Bishop of Lyon, who is from Smyrna in the 2nd century, and Benedict, a great theologian himself, called Irenaeus the first great theologian of the church. And what is interesting, basically, the Pope is talking about authentic church teaching, going back to the original, to the apostles, and he said, authentic church teaching is transmitted by the apostles. It is not invented by intellectuals. And I suppose you could actually take this in the European Union speech and weave a tapestry out of the thoughts in both of these areas. He said, Irenaeus preached the gospel that was preached by his teacher Polycarp, who in turn received it from the apostle John in an unbroken line of succession going back to Christ himself. And he said, the authentic teaching is not that invented by intellectuals over and above the simple faith of the church. The true gospel is the one imparted by the bishops who received it from the gospels in an uninterrupted chain. And in particular, he said, Catholics have a duty to listen to their bishops, and of those bishops in particular, to the Bishop of Rome, who, of course, is the Holy Father. And he talked about the Church of Rome, who, because of her antiquity, has the greatest degree of apostolicity and whose origins are in the pillars of the Apostolic College, which, of course, is Saints Peter and Paul. So very, very interesting audience, and I imagine there might be a few people in other Christian denominations who might be taking apart this discorso, this audience of the Holy Father, and looking at it very carefully. Well, you know, we're getting real short here on time, and I think that if people kind of stay tuned to what's happening in the church, we've got a lot of big of events coming up. Palm Sunday, World Youth Day.
Next week is Holy Week.
Hopefully we said that at the beginning of the program.
So God bless.
So we'll tune in on Holy Thursday.
And so we have come to the end of the program for this week. You can hear us all again at the same time next week, or at your leisure, by going to the internet and clicking on vaticanradio.org/English. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.